Studio 360.
There are excellent performances this year in excellent movies. For instance, the literary caper Can You Ever Forgive Me features a terrific one by Richard E. Grant. His first movie, the 1987 classic With Mel and I, and his most recent, Can You Ever Forgive Me, have some things in common. Neither had very big budgets. Both are dark comedies set 20 or 30 years before they came out. Both are about an odd couple of bohemian drinking buddies living in squalor. And each features Richard E. Grant superbly playing a character who's a fascinating mix of swagger and pathos, dissolute and grand at the same moment. Grant played Withnall in Withnall and I as this unstable, untrustworthy, unemployed actor.
I must have some booze. I demand to have some booze! This is a far superior drink to meths. Wankers don't drink it because they can't afford it.
And in Can You Ever Forgive Me, he plays a charming, untrustworthy, real-life grifter named Jack Hawk. He is the confidant and then co-conspirator of the real-life literary forger Lee Israel, played by Melissa McCarthy.
Last time I saw you, thank you, we were both pleasantly pissed at some horrible book party. Am I right?
It's slowly flooding back to me.
Can I buy you a drink? Even though you're the posh writer.
Thank you.
Craigie, top her up.
The role just got Grant his first Academy Award nomination, as well as a gazillion other nominations and awards. And he is here to talk about Withnall and Jack Hawk and some other character he's played during the 30 years in between. Richard E. Grant, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much.
And you are here where Lee Israel was 5 years ago.
Seriously?
Yes, indeed.
Well, please tell me about her.
She was full of energy and fun and not very contrite.
And how difficult was she?
Not at all. She was happy to be here.
Gosh, yeah. That's unusual to hear.
Yes.
Except I keep hearing how curmudgeonly and prickly she was.
You have obviously an English accent, but you have a distinct accent that you attribute entirely to your somewhat peculiar growing up.
I grew up in Swaziland, which is the smallest country in the Southern Hemisphere. And it's in Southeast Africa between Mozambique and South Africa. And it was under British protectorate jurisdiction when I was growing up, because my father was the Minister of Education, which is why I went to school there. And so I suppose the way that I speak is, people identified it when I emigrated to London in 1982, that it was like somebody who spoke from the 1950s, because the expatriate community there, I suppose, were in a time warp.
Does it make you seem more posh than you were?
I'm sure it does. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And Swaziland is no longer Swaziland. I looked it up.
Yes.
It's the kingdom of...
Two months ago, the king changed its name on the 50th anniversary of its independence from the British. So it's now called Eswatini.
So this diction, owing to your colonialist childhood, did it affect the roles for which you were cast?
You know, if you're an English actor, you inevitably get cast in everything from Agatha Christie to Dickens to historically based projects. So I think that's probably because of the way I look and sound that has affected my casting.
Yeah.
It's almost for somebody else to decide how and what you do. And usually the experience is that a casting director or a director chooses you according to how they think you fit into their vision of something. So you're kind of, you know, tart for hire, really.
Yeah. Tart for Hire. The next memoir you can write called Tart for Hire.
Tart for Hire.
Growing up in Southern Africa, did you decide at 5 or 10 or 12 that you wanted to be an actor? How did that come about?
It didn't seem realistic from where I grew up, because there was no precedent for it, to earn your living as an actor. And I think my father thought that I'd be destitute and spend my life, you know, wearing makeup and tights. So,
and there you go.
There I am.
And you have.
As I'm sitting here now, fully made up. In tights as we speak.
So with Withnall and I, it's hard to think of many more memorable debuts in film than you had in that movie.
Well, thank you. The irony is that I played an unemployed actor, and that film has led to every subsequent job that I've ever had.
So how did Bruce Robinson, the writer and director of With Null and I, find you, end up casting you?
He had offered it to Daniel Day-Lewis, and because he turned that down to do The Unbearable Lightness of Being, it then left the field open for everybody else.
He's a drinker, a terrible drinker in that film. Uh-huh. And you aren't and haven't been ever, right?
No. My father was an alcoholic and my grandfather was, and I assume that
you didn't take up the family tradition.
Yeah, the family tradition. I thought I might have been because I couldn't keep alcohol down for more than 10 minutes and I thought it was psychosomatic. And I had a blood test with a doctor when I was 17 and he said, you have no enzyme, you can never ever drink, it's completely toxic. So I have no experience of alcohol whatsoever.
But you were able to observe people in drunken conditions.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That fierce concentration that they need, you know, to get across a room, trying to not appear drunk. So that seemed to me the key to how to play it.
I want to talk about one of my very favorite scenes in that film, which is the ending.
Yes.
Your character says goodbye to his friend, the Paul McGann character, and leaves you standing alone at the zoo in London. And you, playing Whitnall, launches into this speech, and this is it.
What a piece of work is a man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, how like an angel in apprehension, how like a god! The beauty of the world, paragon of animals. Yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust?
That was you giving this magnificent soliloquy. You took off your headphones. You don't want to hear yourself?
No. Do you like listening back to yourself?
I don't hate it.
Yeah, I hate it.
Really?
Yeah. I always just hear or see what's
wrong. Yeah, I get that. So knowing that character as well as anybody, why does he give that speech? Why is that his...
Because he never succeeded as an actor. And so the only audience he has at the end of that story when his friend has finally got a first big theater break and leaves... He only has the wolves in the London Zoo as his audience, and they are not appreciative of his efforts.
I laughed out loud again, as I do every time I see it, when halfway, two-thirds of the way through the speech, the wolf looking up at him just walks away.
Yeah.
It's pretty lovely. You worked with Robinson twice, but then you worked with Robert Altman.
Three times, yes,
right?
Absolutely wonderfully.
The Player, one of my favorite movies of all time.
Thank you.
Prêt-à-porter. And Gosford Park.
Mm-hmm.
Famously, he encouraged actors to improvise.
Yes, which is a real gift. And where it worked best was in The Player and in Gosford Park. They were very, very tightly scripted. And then he encouraged and allowed for and accommodated improvisation around that script.
In The Player, you play a screenwriter. Do you remember any... specific ad-libs of yours that made it into the finished film?
Oh, yeah. A lot of the pitch that I gave, because I know a fair number of screenwriters in L.A., and I went to all of them and I said, can you please show me or tell me what are the most extreme things you've done in pitch meetings? And so I took notes and improvised quite a lot of that.
Cut from the DA to an upmarket suburban neighborhood. It's murder. The DA decides to go for the big one. He's going to put the wife in the gas chamber. Then he finds that the husband is alive, that he faked his death. The DA breaks into the prison, runs down death row, but he gets there too late. She's dead. I tell you, there's not a dry eye in the house.
More recently, and of course we could go on for hours because... I started counting the roles on IMDb. I got up to 50 on feature films, and I didn't.
That's because I'm so old.
I didn't. Well, I mean, both of us. But I didn't even count the television roles, of which you've done probably as many, including recently Game of Thrones, Isambaro.
Yeah.
For the five or six non-viewers of Game of Thrones, explain who he is.
He is a manager of a troupe of traveling players in Game of Thrones, and then. They reenact some of the key episodes of this story.
Here's a scene. After performance of your play, you're the writer as well as the lead actor. Your leading lady, Lady Crane, played by Essie Davis, suggests that you revise your script.
Yes, you are adored by people and animals alike.
I do what I can with what I'm given.
Do
what you're given.
Well, I was thinking.
Oh, we're all thinkers now, are we? Fool to the tits with ideas.
I didn't mean...
You have ideas, I have ideas, he has ideas. Why should my ideas have any more value than yours? Simply because I've been doing this my whole life. Who's anyone to judge my work? This is my profession. I know what I'm doing. You have no right to an opinion.
The creators of the show were Withnell fans, and they had said to Nina Gold, the casting director, we have to find the Game of Thrones version of Withnell for this traveling player. So that's how that came about.
So Jack Hawk in Can You Ever Forgive Me? That was a real person?
A real person. He's from Portland in Oregon, and he died at the age of 47 in 1994 of AIDS. There are no photographs of him. And
which is weird.
Yeah, and there are no friends of his are still alive because they all died of AIDS. So, and we've surmised that he was disowned by his family because we have no record of that. Although I'm surprised that with this movie going out, somebody on his family hasn't come forward to claim him. And when I was cast, I asked Marielle Heller, our wonderful director, whether I was to do a Portland accent or a New York. And she said, no, I don't want that. I want you to speak as you do. So I was somewhat disappointed because I thought this was my chance to play an American again. But
British actors must do.
Yeah, that's what she wanted. So I didn't argue.
But given what a cipher he was, you might as well have lived in the 18th century or earlier. How did you figure out how to play him?
From Lee Israel's memoir, I found that he had used a little stubby cigarette holder, and I asked if I could use that because I thought that immediately gave me a sense of, I suppose, a kind of Peter O'Toole sense of self-image that involves that. Yes. Because I've never met any man in my real life who smokes with a cigarette holder that lives, you know, beyond 1954. So I took that. And the other thing that she revealed in the memoir is that once she had been rumbled by the FBI and could no longer go out and sell these forged letters, Jack Hawk went out, and where she anticipated that he'd come back with $300-400, he would manage to fleece people of 2,000. So I knew from that he had some kind of street smarts or charm that he could go and do that.
Well, it's interesting that you say that this Peter O'Toole 1954 thing. Again, it sounds as though this dated bubble in which you grew up, yeah, which was still 1954 when you were growing up in 1973,
yeah,
maybe gave you a way into that as well?
Yes, probably. Yeah. That's for you, Dr. Freud, to decide.
Okay, well, our 15 minutes are up.
Okay.
Here's a clip.
You're friends with Julia
something. Steinberg.
Yeah.
She's not an agent anymore. She died.
She did? Jesus, that's young.
Maybe she didn't die. Maybe she just moved back to the suburbs. I was confused, those two. No, that's right. She got married and had twins.
Better to have died.
Indeed.
That is Richard E. Grant and Melissa McCarthy in Can You Ever Forgive Me? And watching that, I'm reminded that Mariel Heller, the director, was correct, I think, in having you be English. Right?
Okay.
I mean, it just sells the particular charming rogue thing more easily than if you had a Portland accent. I'm not sure there is such a thing, but, you know.
Well, take your word for it.
I think.
I'm not arguing.
Last but not least, you're in the next Star Wars movie.
I am.
The final Star Wars movie.
Star Wars movie, which comes out on the 19th of December.
Bad guy? Good guy?
I have no idea.
Really?
I'm not allowed to. It is, the embargo on information is so Fort Knox-like that to reassure you, my wife and daughter do not know the name of my character.
Really?
Yeah.
So you do know the name of your character, and you do know if he's bad or good.
I do know all those things, yes.
Wow. What would they do to you if you just sort of talked about it right now, do you think?
I think I'd be kneecapped and fired. And probably cut out of
the movie. Cut out your things? Yeah.
Cut out your things.
And I'll bet J.J. Abrams is directing this, right?
He is, yeah.
And I'm betting he's a big Withnell and I fan. Did he say that?
He is, yeah. But I mean, he's a big, yeah, he's a movie geek. So
I know.
He has seen and knows everything.
So awards, who cares, right?
Oh, if you've never been nominated for anything in your life and you suddenly at my age get, you know, a landslide of them and awards from critics and things, that I do not take lightly, and I've enjoyed every nanosecond of the ride so far.
Nice.
I don't feel cynical about it at all. I'm thrilled.
Yes. Well, enjoy it.
I am.
Richard E. Grant, this was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Richard E. Grant has been nominated for a bunch of awards this year and won some. You can watch Can You Ever Forgive Me on Amazon or iTunes, and you can also listen to my interview with the real Lee Israel at studio360.org.